that today, those who most aggressively celebrate your decision are the biggest economic interest in broadcasting in this country. Are they not the ones that are celebrating your decision?
I have no idea who's celebrating my decision.
You really don't? Are you kidding me?
Senator, I also know that there's a hand...
Hey, wait, let me stay... But are you kidding me? You really don't know who's celebrating that decision?
I'll tell you what, me and the staff are celebrating being complete with this.
The FCC's Michael Powell being questioned by Senator Byron Dorgan. Tomorrow, the Senate Commerce Committee decides whether to roll back some of the FCC's rulings, allowing massive media consolidation. What really happened in Fallujah? A new report sheds light on the U.S. military shootings that killed 17 Iraqis. And we take a look at the new Republican National Committee Chair, Ed Gillespie, one of the chief corporate lobbyists in Washington. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Federal Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C. yesterday ruled the Justice Department can secretly detain immigrants without ever publicly releasing their names, the release for the arrests, or the names of their attorneys. Attorney Kate Martin said, for the first time in U.S. history, a court has approved secret arrests. Martin, who heads the Center for National Security Studies, said her organization and others in the case may appeal the ruling. A coalition of civil liberties groups had filed suit in order to obtain the names of more than 750 immigrants who were secretly picked up after September 11th. A Washington Post editorial described the court's move as a, quote, dreadful decision. Last night, free speech attorney Martin Garbus quoted the dissenting judge in the case.
Public's interest in knowing whether the government, in responding to the attacks, is violating the constitutional rights of the hundreds of persons whom it has detained in connection with its terrorism investigation by, as the plaintiffs allege, detaining them mainly because of their religion or ethnicity, holding them in custody for extended periods without charging or preventing them from seeking or communicating with legal counsel. The government claims that the detainees have access to counsel and freedom to contact whoever they wish. But that has turned out not to be so.
We'll have more on that story later in the program. In Baghdad, U.S. troops opened fire on Iraqi demonstrators this morning during a protest outside the main gate of the presidential compound. Iraqi protesters said two demonstrators were killed. The Pentagon acknowledged Iraqis had been shot, but denied that anyone died. Demonstrations outside the Republican Palace have been frequent since coalition forces captured the Iraqi capital in April. Protests have often arisen over unpaid wages to civil servants and the army. Meanwhile, a sniper yesterday shot and killed a U.S. soldier on patrol in Baghdad. This is the 11th time in the past 3 weeks a U.S. soldier has been killed in Iraq. The Financial Times is reporting that conservative Republicans backed by some Democrats are seizing on anti-government protests in Iran as an opportunity to press the Bush administration to adopt regime change in Iran as official policy. Republican Senator Sam Brownback of Kansas told the Financial Times he had support from high levels of the Pentagon for a bill to support peaceful regime change in Iran. Brownback wants to give opposition groups and broadcasters more than $50 million there. He said he would also consider expanding his proposed Iran Democracy Act to include funding for covert operations. Meanwhile, influential Pentagon advisor Richard Perle said yesterday the way to stop Iran from becoming a nuclear power is to, quote, liberate the Iranian people. While praising the recent student protests, Perle said, quote, We can already see signs that Iranians would like to see regime change. They should be encouraged, he said. In London, Prime Minister Tony Blair came under increasing criticism over Iraq. Former Foreign Secretary Robin Cook said it was, quote, now clear that Saddam Hussein does not represent a clear and serious threat. Then former Blair cabinet member Claire Short said Blair had made a secret agreement last summer with George Bush to invade Iraq in February or March. She went on to say Blair, quote, used a series of half-truths, exaggerations, reassurances that were not the case to get us into conflict by spring. She also claimed the British intelligence and diplomatic community had privately opposed the war. Today in Washington, closed-door hearings will begin on Capitol Hill to discuss the Iraq intelligence scandal. French police have detained nearly 160 members of the Iranian opposition group, the People's Mujahideen of Iran. More than 1,300 police officers took part in the raid that targeted 13 addresses in Paris. The group is on both terrorist lists of the European Union and the United States. But The Guardian of London reports members of the group have had close communication with the Bush administration. The Washington Post is reporting that Idaho Governor Dirk Kempthorne has become the leading candidate to become the new administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency. The Republican received a near zero rating from the League of Conservation Voters during his one term as senator. The Post reports Kempthorne has frequently raised the ire of advocacy groups because of his desire to reduce the role of the federal government in environmental policy. Philip Clapp, president of the National Environmental Trust, said, quote, that's nothing more than spin. Governor Kempthorne has supported the chemical industry, the oil industry, the timber industry, and the utility industry against virtually every environmental proposal since 1993. In his first major fundraiser for the 2004 campaign, President Bush raked in $3.5 million at a cocktail party in Washington last night. Attendees paid $2,000. The featured items on the menu were hot dogs and nachos. President Bush issued guidelines yesterday barring federal law enforcement agents from using race or ethnicity in all investigations except those that involve terrorism and national security matters. The Washington Post reports this is the first time the federal government has imposed across-the-board guidelines on racial profiling. But the ACLU disputed the significance. The head of the group's Washington office said this policy acknowledges racial profiling as a national concern, but it does nothing to stop it. It's largely a rhetorical statement. The administration is trying to soften its image, but it's smoke and mirrors. The ACLU noted that Bush only issued guidelines on the matter, not an executive order. The governor of Michigan has declared a state of emergency in the town of Benton Harbor as hundreds of people protested for a second night over the death of a 28-year-old African-American motorcyclist who died while being chased by police. Police fired tear gas and non-lethal projectiles this morning. At least five buildings and five cars have been burned in the town during the two nights of protests. Police arrested at least seven people. The charges were not announced. Police said protesters had threatened to set fire to Benton Harbor Police Headquarters, City Hall, and police vehicles. The Herald Palladium of St. Joseph reported media vehicles and reporters were targeted at one point as a car had its windows smashed. Residents interviewed by the Associated Press said Benton Harbor's problems were the result of years of police harassment. Antonio Cornelius said, quote, we're tired of it now. We're tired of it. Cornelius said his cousin, 11-year-old Trenton Patterson, was struck on a sidewalk and killed 3 years ago during a pursuit involving police from nearby Benton Township. And in Brooklyn, New York, a graduation ceremony descended into an attack by security guards on the parents of the grammar school children who were graduating. In the New York Daily News, it said parents said the violence started when a guard shoved a woman who was yelling. They quote a man named Stephen Grant who said, "Suddenly this woman, the security guard, comes out and starts spraying mace on my girlfriend's face and all over the crowd." And finally, Liberia's President Charles Taylor yesterday pledged to yield power as part of a ceasefire with rebels, but his government quickly hedged on the resignation. In Monrovia, the Associated Press reported Taylor's spokesman said the signing of the ceasefire was the only binding part of the accord. The BBC reports Taylor said he would only step down if war crimes charges against him are dropped. And the BBC reports rebels are already accusing soldiers loyal to President Charles Taylor of breaking the ceasefire.
Stony the road we trod, bitter the chastening rod, felt in the days when hope, unborn, had died,
yet with a steady beat,
have not our weary feet, they come to the place,
Lift Every Voice and Sing, Linda Tillery and the Cultural Heritage Choir. Here on Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman. The Senate Commerce Committee will consider legislation on Thursday to roll back parts of the media ownership rules approved by the Federal Communications Commission on June 2nd. A bipartisan group of U.S. senators plan to push the legislation that would bar a company from owning a television station, a newspaper, and radio outlets in a single market. Senator Byron Dorgan plans to offer an amendment that would prevent a TV network from owning television stations that collectively reach 35% of the national audience. The FCC raised that cap to 45%. Dorgan's expected to be joined by Democratic Senators Ron Wyden of Oregon and Ernest Hollings, as well as Republican Senators Olympia Snowe of Maine, Kay Bailey Hutchison of Texas, and Trent Lott of Mississippi. Already two TV networks, Viacom with its CBS and UPN networks, as well as News Corp's Fox, are above the national television audience cap. Both networks had lobbied the FCC to eliminate the cap. Tribune Company, which owns both television stations and newspapers, and other companies had lobbied the FCC to lift the 28-year-old ban preventing a company from owning a newspaper and television serving the same market. Before we go to our guests, we're going to go to the tape of the Senate Commerce Committee hearing that was held the day after the FCC made its ruling that could lead to the largest media concentration in U.S. history. This is Senator Dorgan addressing FCC Chair Michael Powell on June 3rd.
Chairman Powell, I regret to be so hard on the commission on this decision because I like you personally, but you know from what I have said, I just think this is a decision by a regulatory agency that appears toothless to me. In the shadow of the largest corporate scandals in the history of this country, the last thing we need is to have regulators with no teeth. I want regulators to be tigers on behalf of the public interest. And it looks for all the world to me, and I think it looks for all the world to the rest of the American people, like the majority of the FCC could not or would not stand up against the interest of the big business here. Now, let me describe a couple things that I see in this process. Where I really believe you're wrong. You say this was an open process. One hearing in Richmond, Virginia. Sure, you got a lot of comments, But there's no substitute for going around the country holding open hearings. You say they're modest changes. Clearly they're not modest changes. When in nearly 200 cities, newspapers will be able to buy the television station. You say that it'll promote more competition. Nonsense. The evidence suggests that is simply not the case. You say that there'll be few mergers and acquisitions. Of course, that stands logic on its head. And you say the court made us do it. The court didn't make you do it. I mean, this is the old joke in the movie, who are you going to believe, me or your own eyes? Look, the evidence is in on all of these issues, Mr. Chairman. And I guess let me ask this question this way, because I believe it appears to me so evident that the big interests were served here at the expense of the public interest. Would you not agree with me that today those who most aggressively celebrate your decision are the biggest economic interests in broadcasting in this country? Are they not the ones that are celebrating your decision?
I have no idea who's celebrating our decision.
You really don't? Are you kidding me?
Senator, I also know that there's a hand...
Wait, let me stay... But are you kidding me? You really don't know who's celebrating that decision?
I'll tell you what, me and the staff are celebrating being completed with the decision.
All right,
I know
fair
that.
Enough. But let me just refer you to then to the major newspapers in the country and refer you to the stories following your decision. It's quite clear, Mr. Chairman, that the big public interests were served here, the big economic interests, I should say, were served, and the public interest, in my judgment, was disturbed. But let me also ask, what's the basis, especially given what we now know about concentration and mergers in radio and television, what's the basis for suggesting this substantial change in the rules will not lead to greater concentration? I've heard you suggest, well, this may not lead to greater concentration at all. What's the basis for your belief in that?
Well, Senator, if you don't mind, with respect to which market or which sets of
radio, television, do you believe that as a result of what you have done, there will be greater concentration in television broadcasting companies?
I think there'll be an increase in mergers. I think there will be not an extensive increase in concentration to the levels which would cause great public policy concern, because we did draw significant and meaningful limits.
And that was FCC Chair Michael Powell being questioned by Democratic Senator Byron Dorgan of the Senate Commerce Committee, which will be making some rulings tomorrow. In a minute, we'll be joined by Professor Robert McChesney. But right now, we are on the line with Mark Wigfield, who is a Wall Street Journal reporter who's been covering the Federal Communications Commission. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Morning.
You did a very interesting piece the day the FCC handed down its ruling, had its vote, which was a vote to relax media ownership rules that could launch the largest wave of media consolidation in the history. Can you talk about who got a chance leading up to this decision to meet with the FCC?
Who got a chance to meet? Yeah. Largely the commission is lobbied by, the Washington's professional lobbyists, by industry folks. There are a number of consumer groups, 4 or 5, that regularly meet with the commission, but clearly they don't have the forces to match industry and the number of companies. And my article was about a Bear Stearns analyst named Victor Miller. And Mr. Miller had a sort of unusual position in that he is seen by the commission certainly as what they call a facts and figures guy. He provides, industry numbers. He provides, scenarios, what will happen with competition, et cetera, and sort of makes projections about what will happen, as the industry is configured differently as consolidation occurs. And he also brings in other investors, institutional investors, to learn about where the commission is going. But he does have very strong points of view about a number of these issues that he's expresses in various forums, generally siding with the industry's view that deregulation is necessary. And while he says he doesn't make make this case while he's visiting the commissioners, he does so in forums. At the same time, Bear Stearns does have positions in or has made recommendations about a number of the major companies that are affected by the proceeding, Viacom, Gray, Lin, Fox, sort of a who's who of the media industry.
And can you talk about not only Victor Miller, the Bear Stearns media analyst, but the former FCC commissioner, Richard Wiley?
Yeah, Mr. Wiley is probably the best-connected telecommunications media lobbyist in town. He's a Republican. He's very well connected. He's friendly with many of the commissioners. Some of them have actually worked for him in a prior capacity. Kevin Martin, I believe, worked for his firm, Wiley Ryan and Fielding. Now he Bear Stearns is a client of Mr. Wiley's, and so Mr. Wiley sometimes accompanies Victor Miller, Mr. Miller, to these meetings. Mr. Wiley says he doesn't generally speak at these meetings, but just goes along and learns some things. But he also has, Mr. Wiley was instrumental in the newspaper broadcast cross-ownership relief. This is the rule that in the past prevented newspapers and television stations from owning each other in a community, and then that was substantially relaxed in some communities, most communities, I'm sorry, about 85% of them, only the smallest ones, is there's still a ban. But he has a finger in a lot of different pies, a lot of different clients, is trusted and is certainly respected by the commission as a former chairman himself.
He was against further media consolidation as commissioner, now for it.
He was instrumental in writing the newspaper broadcast cross-ownership rule. That's correct. He talks about how, well, he was right then, but things have changed, so now so he's right now. His position has changed. Whether it's anybody's guess as to whether he's simply reflecting his clients or whether he's has truly had a change of heart in this. But at any rate, it is somewhat ironic that he was in the position of writing that rule and now is really seen key in largely overturning it.
Mark Whitfield of the Wall Street Journal is our guest. You write in your piece, Bear Stearns has a banking relationship with Viacom. Of course, Bear Stearns is where Victor Miller comes from, who has met scores of times with the FCC. Bear Stearns has a banking relationship with Viacom, owners of the CBS network, which has sought outright repeal of the FCC's 35% cap. It's earned fees for investment banking from News Corp's Fox Network, which joined Viacom in seeking repeal of the cap. It is told investors there's lots of potential upside at radio company Clear Channel Communications and has underwritten initial public offerings for the nation's second largest radio broadcaster, Cumulus Media, as well as for the seventh largest, Radio One, Inc. Like Clear Channel, both companies recently asked the FCC to retain local market definitions. Bear Stearns also has a banking relationship with Sinclair Broadcast, Inc., which mounted a successful court challenge to the FCC's duopoly rule that limits common ownership of two television stations in a single market. It also has banking relationships with Gray Television and Lin TV Corp, which seek relaxation of the rule. Bear Stearns analysts, including Mr. Miller, have positive ratings on many of these stocks. And then you quote Jeff Chester, who is the public interest advocate, one of the leaders of the push against media deregulation, saying the FCC should require more disclosure. How much disclosure does it require?
You have to file, if you go to visit the FCC, you have to file what's called an ex parte, which simply states that you met and kind of the outline of the, a little bit of the outline of what you talked about. It depends on the company or on the lobbyist as to how detailed. Some are very sketchy. Some are not. There's nothing comparable to the congressional lobbyist registration. Not that that is any great rule either, but there's nothing that requires sort of, for example, with Mr. Miller, for him to necessarily list his clients when he visits the FCC or to list Bear Stearns' you know, various relationships with these companies. There's no requirement that happen. Now, he does do this when he is, you know, invited to speak. He's been invited to speak at FCC forums. He spoke at their public hearing, I believe, in February in Richmond, and he does various forums in Washington and elsewhere where he does disclose these things. So it's not that he's necessarily trying to hide it in public forums, but certainly there's nothing at the FCC that requires him to to list these things.
And in terms of numbers of meetings that people like Victor Miller had, other corporate representatives had, versus public interest representatives with the FCC, have you broken that down?
Well, the Center for Public Integrity did a study on that, which we cited in the paper, and I'm trying to look for the number, but I believe the numbers are something like, well, I don't have them, but it's a fraction. I mean, it was something like five, compared to 70. I'm looking through the article right now and trying to find the Center for Public Integrity's study said that the broadcasters, the nation's broadcasters, have met in 70 face-to-face meetings with FCC officials since September. Public interest groups saw them five times in the same period. So this is basically, they figured this out by going through these so-called ex parte filings to see who had met with the commission over that period.
Mark Wigfield, I want to thank you for being with us. Mark Wigfield with the Wall Street Journal. You are listening to Democracy Now! We come back from our break. Professor Robert McChesney, thank you. Stay with us.
And admit that the waters around you have grown, and accepted that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you'd better start swimming, or you'll sink like a stone. 'Cause the times, they are a-changing. Come writers, come critics, you who prophesy with your pen, keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin. And there's no telling who it is naming, for the loser now will be later.
Richie Havens singing Times They Are Changing, or not. This is Amy Goodman. You're listening to Democracy Now!, and we are joined by Robert McChesney, professor of communications at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, author of a number of books on media, among them Rich Media, Poor Democracy. Can you tell us about the significance of the hearing that will take place tomorrow, Professor McChesney?
I'd be glad to, Amy. What's going to take place is there are two amendments to overturn two of the four rule changes that the SEC approved on June 2nd, as you talked about actually earlier in the show, one of which is the rule change which will allow companies to increase the percentage of the country they own TV stations in from 35% to 45%. And let's make clear that 45% is a very soft figure, because what are called UHF stations, traditionally the stations broadcast over channel 13 on the dial, only count as half a station, even though 80% of the American population, that's an irrelevant distinction since they get their channels through satellite or cable. But because of that, a company can actually own up to 70, 80, even 90% technically of the nation, not 45%. So they can virtually cover the entire nation strategically. The second ruling is what I think the most important of the two that will be voted on is the cross-ownership lifting. On June 2nd, the SEC voted so that a company can now own the only newspaper in almost every town, plus television and radio stations in the same community. And this will lead to a dramatic shift in power in local communities around the country. There's an amendment by Dorgan and Snow, the Democrat and Republican Dorgan, who we heard earlier in the program, to overturn that. So those are the two that are being voted on in the Commerce Committee tomorrow. If they win in the Commerce Committee in the Senate, and I think there's a good chance they will, certainly the television cap will win, then they go to a vote of the whole Senate.
We're talking to Professor McChesney. Can you talk about how this hearing is going to take place tomorrow, when it seemed that for the last months, the entire thrust has been around June 2nd? Everything has been focused on June 2nd being the last date, that it's the day the FCC will make its decision. It seemed after that it could not be changed. What's happened?
Well, I think that it was a mistake by the organizers, and I include myself in that, too, for putting too much emphasis on June 2nd. I mean, we did, because that was the crucial vote by the FCC, but lost in the shuffle was the crucial point that the FCC is an agency that simply is supposed to reflect the will of Congress, which reflects our will, and they're not supposed to do stuff Congress doesn't want them to do. And in fact, Michael Pollan and the FCC, their main argument for, the majority's main argument for doing what they did, is they claimed Congress wanted them to do this. So Congress can easily just tell the FCC, no, we didn't want you to do this. And if they do that, the FCC has to rescind. They're not like the Supreme Court or something, that they have some tremendous autonomy. They're not supposed to have autonomy just to serve, act privately on behalf of private interests. They're supposed to reflect the will of Congress and the will of the people of the country on paper, in theory. So I think really the fight has always been ultimately about Congress. Congress has the power, it's within Congress's power to overturn what the SEC has done, and to make it clear to the SEC that the point of the SEC isn't simply to serve private corporate interests, as it generally has done, and as it certainly has done in this instance. One of the things that's most striking about this, and I think Mark Wiggins' point that in your last interview just made it clear, is how incredibly corrupt this process has been at the FCC, where you have basically on one side of the table all this big money and powerful lobbyists who stand to benefit. And the other side of the table, you have virtually every person in the United States otherwise, and across the political spectrum. Nobody likes the idea of letting fewer companies on more and more media.
We're talking to Bob McChesney. What about the Republican senators who are joining with the Democratic senators, and where does McCain stand? I mean, people like Trent Lott and Olympia Snow of Washington. Olympia Snow of Maine and Trent Lott of Mississippi.
And a real champion here as a Republican. She's taking tremendous pressure from the White House, as are all the Republicans. Beneath the scenes here, because President Bush doesn't want to be outspoken on this because it's such an unpopular issue, but beneath the scenes, the Bush White House has been working the Hill, Karl Rove, trying to whip people into shape to support the FCC, because this is payback time for the big media companies that have been supporting the Bush administration both financially and ideologically over the last few years, and in fact over the entirety of Bush's career. And Olympia Snow and the Republicans are taking tremendous heat to fall in line, and it's to their great credit that they haven't. Olympia Snow is actually been great across the board on these issues. She's the co-sponsor, helping to support Dorgan's amendment to rescind, to keep cross-ownership, basically, in our media ownership, to make it impossible to own TV and newspapers in the same community. Trent Lott's sort of a strange case. People are surprised to see his name. He has basically come out against raising the caps on the number of TV stations a single company can own. This has actually always been Trent Lott's position, because Trent Lott has been closely associated with the small television station-owning companies as opposed to the big companies. There's sort of been a split in the commercial community, and he's always been on the side of the smaller station owners who want to keep a cap, because they know as soon as you get rid of the cap on the number of TV stations you can own in television, or raise it like they will, it wipes out all the smaller stations, just like what happened in radio, where all the small station owners were forced to sell out because they couldn't compete after the caps were relaxed in 1996. And I think, you know, the Republicans also, we have to understand, they're not getting anyone in their districts emailing, calling, or writing saying, hey, we like the idea of having fewer media owners. The entirety of public opinion is opposed to this, almost without exception. The entirety, nobody likes this. The only people who like it are, again, these powerful lobbies. Traditionally, the way media policies have been done in the United States has been entirely behind closed doors, no public participation. We wouldn't be having this show, Amy. No one would know about it, and they get away with murder. Now, finally, people are waking up to it. They're registering their opinion, and the opinion is virtually unanimous. So even Republican politicians you know, have to pay attention. They have to run for re-election. They have to pay attention to what their constituents are saying. And their constituents are saying virtually unanimously, stop this. This is absurd.
Does it matter now if people let their senators know how they feel for tomorrow's hearing and McCain himself?
It's absolutely mandatory. Not only do people let their senators know and their members of the House know about tomorrow, but there's a series of legislative maneuvers and bills that will take place in the next 2 or 3 weeks beyond tomorrow that are central. In the House of Representatives, Representative Bernie Sanders of Vermont has introduced a bill which would overturn all of the FCC's regulations. He's already gotten around 30 co-sponsors, including a Republican, at least one. And it would remove the power of the SEC to change these rules. It would put the power back in Congress's hands. And that's a bill people should support. Now, will it pass in the House? Will it even be able to get through Tom DeLay and Billy Tosin, the head of the Senate House Commerce Committee, will get through? Possibly not. But the more support it gets, the more members of House understand the constituents support this, the easier it will be for some sort of compromise to be worked out down the road. So I would say right now it is absolutely essential for listeners to get in touch with their members of the House and Congress. And there is a place you can go for one-stop click for all the campaigns that are working on this. It's mediareform.net, mediareform.net, which is put on by a group I helped form, Free Press, but it's sort of an amalgam of all the groups working on the issues. And if you go there, it also has daily updates on what's taking place in the Hill. So if you want to know what the situation is on Friday, you can go there and we'll have people file reports exactly where the action is going.
Well, Robert McChesney, I want to thank you for being with us, Professor of Communications at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, author of many books on media, including Rich Media, Poor Democracy. You are listening to Democracy Now! As we continue to look at corporate America. Enron, Microsoft, Verizon, Viacom, Tyson Foods, DirecTV, Daimler Chrysler. These are just some of the corporations that have hired lobbyist Ed Gillespie in recent years. Enron alone paid Gillespie's firm $700,000 to lobby the White House on electricity crisis on the West Coast. But now Gillespie has a new client, the Republican National Committee. On Monday, President Bush tapped him to serve as the RNC's new head. As party chair, Ed Gillespie will work closely with the White House and congressional leaders on policy matters and election strategy. Gillespie told the New York Times he would retain his stake in his lobbying firm, but would do no work and collect no salary for as long as he's a party official. In 2000, Gillespie co-founded the lobbying firm Quinn Gillespie and Associates, which quickly grew into Washington's one of its most powerful lobbying groups. We're joined now by Joan Claybrook, president of Public Citizen. Her group just published a report entitled Ed Gillespie, the Embedded Lobbyist, New Chairman Brings Corporate Loyalties to Top Job in the GOP. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Joan Claybrook.
Thank you.
Well, can you talk more about Ed Gillespie?
Well, Ed Gillespie worked his way up through the party structure and worked for members of Congress, including Dick Armey, then in 2000 founded this lobby firm. And it is a very lucrative operation for him. It collected over $27 million in lobbying fees through 2002, so in just 3 years. They got $27 million. And they do represent some of the biggest corporations in America, including as well the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which paid them almost $1 million to lobby for a class action bill that would keep consumers from being able to join together and bring lawsuits very effectively. It would essentially put all these cases in the federal courts. That's a very difficult forum for consumers because the federal courts don't like to certify class actions. So, he has represented the companies that are most anti-consumer. It's really incredible that he is now going to be the head of the Republican National Committee and yet retain his interest in his lobbying firm, although he says he won't take a salary. And he will not actually lobby for his clients. But his clients know and other potential clients know that he's in a position to call the shots, and that's what the companies care about. And so they would clearly, you know, stay with his firm, be added to his firm, so that they can get what they want supported by the administration.
Since the Martha Stewart indictment, a lot of people have been raising questions about why Ken Lay why the government hasn't taken a similar approach to Ken Lay, the former head of Enron. Can you talk more specifically about Gillespie's relationship with Enron?
Well, Quinn Gillespie, the firm that they founded, earned $700,000 from Enron in 2001 alone to lobby the White House on the electricity crisis in the West Coast. Enron was trying to get total deregulation so that they could continue to cook the books. And they also were attempting to influence, of course, the FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, here in Washington. And the administration had aggressively supported Enron's position against re-regulating these markets, and that was one of the pressures that was on the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, was to because of the crisis in California and all the huge increase in costs, to re-regulate. And so he was a key player in that. He also channeled money from Daimler Chrysler and Enron to something called the 21st Energy Project, which bought print and television ads in July 2001 to promote the administration's energy plans, which means deregulation, including blocking fuel economy standards, which Daimler Chrysler was particularly interested in. So he is a handmaiden for whatever the corporate interests are. And those corporate interests generally are anti-consumer and whatever suits the whims of the corporation in terms of increasing their profits, no matter what the cost to the public.
You write in your report, Joan Claybrook, in American politics, few non-governmental positions offer as much potential for corruption as national party chairman. Ed Gillespie's record of advocacy for the interests of corporate America, including some of the country's most infamous corporate wrongdoers, raises serious questions about President Bush's decision to appoint Gillespie to lead the Republican Party. But Bush can choose anyone he wants to head the Republican Party, right?
That's correct.
And so you have put out a major report about Ed Gillespie. But while you talk about Gillespie, what about President Bush in this? And what does it say about President Bush? And do people have any kind of say in a position like this?
Well, what it says about President Bush is that he's what you might call a corporatist. That is, whatever the corporations want, that's what he supports. And it's a vicious circle in many ways for the public, because it's money into the campaigns and then federal benefits allocated to corporations in return. And these are often worth, you know, tens of millions, if not billions of dollars, depending on whether they're tax breaks or prevention of regulation or subsidies, as for example in the nuclear area, and so, or the oil industry. So this is a small collegial group that are manipulating the federal purse on behalf of their contributors. And one of the reasons why consumer groups fought to get rid of soft money was because the party leaders became soft money conduits. They would push certain policies on their party officials, and in return they would go collect huge amounts of soft money, and that could be from corporations or from labor unions or individuals. The soft money ban that's now being litigated in the Supreme Court has stopped the soft money part. But as a part of that same legislation, they increased the hard money from $1,000 to $2,000. And what the Bush administration is doing is setting up a network of key officials, some 500 of them, in corporations across America to go out and collect close to $200 million for his reelection campaign, and Ed Gillespie is going to be intimately involved in that. And so he's going to be using all of his corporate contacts to urge them to bundle money, as it's called. You know, corporation after corporation would go to all the top vice presidents, executive vice presidents, and even below that level, and ask everyone for $2,000. And if you don't give the $2,000, then, you know, you're not considered a loyal corporate official. And so that's just for the presidential campaign, much less for some of the other campaigns for members of Congress, the House and Senate. So this job of the head of the NRC is very, very much a money collection job. And when you have these corporate contacts, it makes it easier. And but they expect something in return. And while Gillespie says he's not going to lobby, you know that anybody he raises money for is going to hear feedback from him about what policies his contributors want to see enacted into law.
Joan Claybrook, I want to thank you for being with us. President Public Citizen, if people want to get a hold of your report, where can they go on the web?
They can go to www.citizen.org. And it's there along with many other things.
Thank you very much, Joan
Claybrook.
Okay, Ed Gillespie, the embedded lobbyist, new chair, brings corporate loyalties to top job in the GOP. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute. Listening to Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman. In Baghdad this morning, U.S. troops opened fire on Iraqi demonstrators during a protest outside the main gate of the presidential compound. Iraqi protesters said two demonstrators were killed. U.S. military is saying a soldier opened fire after the demonstrators started throwing stones at a military convoy, this according to the BBC. Demonstrations outside the Republican Palace have been frequent since coalition forces captured the Iraqi capital in April. Protests have also arisen over unpaid wages to civil servants in the army. Well, now we're going to take another look at another protest in Iraq where U.S. troops opened fire on Iraqi demonstrators. On April 28th, in the town of Fallujah, U.S. troops killed 17 people, injured 70. Witnesses said U.S. troops from the 82nd Airborne Division fired without provocation on an unarmed crowd of protesters outside a local school. The Pentagon claimed its soldiers were fired on by gunmen among the demonstrators, but a new report from Human Rights Watch raises questions as to what actually happened on that day in Fallujah. Fred Abrahams joins us, who's senior researcher of Human Rights Watch, who authored the new report called Violent Response, the U.S. Army in Al-Fallujah. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hi, good morning.
Well, can you tell us what you found?
Sure. Well, the case, I have to say, was a very complex one. There were two versions of the story. The protesters, the U.S. soldiers of the 82nd Airborne claimed that they fired without that they had been shot upon, basically, that they had received effective fire from the crowd and that they responded with what they called precision fire on the shooters inside the crowd. Now, of course, the demonstrators had a completely different version, and everyone that we spoke to, and this is more than 30 people who were either participants in the demonstration or witnesses to it, claimed that there was no shooting whatsoever on U.S. troops and that they were fired on unprovoked. And as you mentioned, there were 17 deaths and more than 70 wounded. The one important fact I would add is the ballistics evidence. We spent a number of hours looking at the school where the U.S. soldiers were based and the street. We were not able to find any conclusive evidence of bullet marks on the school where the 82nd Airborne was based, which placed into question their version of events. In contrast, the wall across the street from the school had a very wide-ranging evidence, that is, spanning over 100 meters, of high-caliber bullet impacts, which, again, they didn't claim that they didn't shoot, but it suggested that their response was wider and more sustained than the precision fire that they claimed that they responded with.
We just have a report in that another Iraqi man has been shot and seriously injured by U.S. troops who opened fire on his car while he was driving in Fallujah.
Well, you know, it's not surprising. Fallujah, from the beginning, it's a very conservative, has a very strong Islamic codes, and there was a great deal of resentment towards the arrival of U.S. troops. And, of course, since the incident, it has become a real hotbed of resistance in what's being called this Sunni triangle, just west and north of Baghdad. So it's become a very uncomfortable place for the U.S. military to be. And one of the things that I believe this incident was really the first major violent altercation, and some of the incidents we're seeing since then may be revenge attacks stemming from that first violent case.
The Pentagon, by the way, refused to come on the show today, though they say they stand by what they have said in the past. How did they concoct the story they did at the beginning?
Well, you know, the initial statements out of CENTCOM were that there were, I believe, 25 shooters in the crowds targeting U.S. troops. That was the initial statement. That was then toned down when we interviewed soldiers. We spoke with three of the soldiers who were in the school, as well as two of their commanders. And I do have to say, for the record, that the U.S. military was open to speaking with us. They gave us what I would consider very good access. They claimed that there were 7 shooters in the crowd on that day. And they walked us through it in great detail. I also have to say, having interviewed those soldiers, that I do believe that they thought they had come under fire to some degree on that day. I don't believe, and we don't claim in the report, that they opened fire randomly on an unarmed demonstration. I believe that they thought that they possibly were, perhaps, and even perhaps there were some provocateurs in the crowd, but all evidence suggests that they really overreacted. And one of the issues here is the notion of putting combat troops into a peacekeeping role. You know, the 82nd Airborne are paratroopers. They had fought their way into Iraq and suffered casualties. And we're really looking at, and the report highlights what I think is the apparent lack of planning and training for the peacekeeping role. You know, it's one thing to fight in a country, and it's another to be a policeman, to engage in community relations, to work on crowd control. And these are all things that it seems the 82nd Airborne were not well prepared to do. And in this case, when things turned violent, they didn't have a nuanced and staged response and reaction. They resorted to what they know best, which is using force, and it had a very lethal effect.
Well, Fred Abrahams, I want to thank you very much for being with us, senior researcher at Human Rights Watch. The report is called Violent Response, the U.S. Army in Fallujah. And by the way, part of the report that we just got in about another Iraqi man who was critically wounded in Fallujah just today In southern Baghdad, two U.S. soldiers guarding a filling station were killed in a hand grenade attack. An AFP photographer witnessed this, Agence France-Presse. An Iraqi policeman confirmed the two soldiers were dead, adding the attackers had fled before U.S. military vehicles and helicopter arrived to remove the bodies. The photographer was then detained by U.S. forces, who held his press pass and confiscated his camera, preventing him from taking photographs of the scene for an hour. A U.S. Army spokesperson was unable to immediately confirm the report. If confirmed by the U.S. military, it brings to 52 the number of U.S. troops killed since President Bush declared war in Iraq, effectively over on May 1st. And finally today, we go back to today's top story, the Justice Department scoring another legal victory. In a 2-1 ruling, a federal court ruled yesterday the Justice Department does not have to disclose the names of over 700 people it has held since September 11th attacks. It reverses a lower court ruling last August that ordered the government to make the public the names of the detainees and their lawyers. The three-judge court ruled against a coalition of more than 20 civil liberties groups and other organizations who invoke the Freedom of Information Act to challenge the secret arrests. The ruling also said the government could keep secret the dates and locations of the arrest, detention, and release of all detainees. We're joined on the phone right now by Kate Martin, the director of the Center for National Security Studies, the chief plaintiff in the case, also the lead attorney in the group. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Can you talk about the significance of this case?
Well, it's the first time that a U.S. court has ever approved secret arrests. So as a matter of principle, it's extraordinary. It's also terrible because what we just learned in the last 10 days, of course, from the Inspector General's report, is that these people were abused when they were in custody, that the secrecy was to cover up a policy of holding them incommunicado, preventing them from hiring lawyers, and during which some of them were beaten up. But I think the other significance of it is, you know, what's going to happen next, and that we have to remember that if what happened was the Justice Department rounded up and secretly jailed 1,000 people who had no connection to terrorism, and that's what it looks like happened, but that's why we need the names, we don't have a Justice Department that's working to make us safer. We simply have a Justice Department that's, you know, conducting a discriminatory dragnet. And we need to know that about our government.
What do you do right now after this federal court ruling?
We're going to appeal, either ask for a rehearing from the court or seek a hearing in the Supreme Court. And we haven't decided which, but we are definitely going to pursue the matter. The other thing is that I think the groups are going to call upon the Congress to demand the names and to outlaw secret arrests.
How many people do you think are being detained right now?
Well, of the original group, only one or two. Most of them were deported. We don't know for sure because the government's never given us a complete accounting. At one time they said there were 1,182 people, but they've only accounted for something in the mid-800s of those people. But what we don't know is whether or not there have been people recently detained by the government who are being held without access to lawyers, et cetera. And there's actually a very disturbing report in Newsweek, which was preceded by a report in the New York Times, indicating that they're holding people without charging them now, including U.S. citizens.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Kate Martin, Director of the Center for National Security Studies. That does it for today's program. If you want to get a copy of the show, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Our website is www.democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Sharif Abdel-Kaddous, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, Noah Rybel, Vilka Tsouras, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for being with us.
All things ain't what they used to be.